Welcome back, those of you who haven't been to anything in 03. We're delighted to see all of you, and we look forward to a busy program in the days and months ahead. I think I knew the speaker's father, and I could introduce him, but we thought it would be quite appropriate, as with anything that we do in the Polish program, the Kosciuszko Chair, that Ambassador John Davis, who's a member of the advisory committee of that group, and indeed our hope for the further development of that program and sharing as much as we can with you. So without further ado, Ambassador Davis.
Well, it's a great pleasure today to be able to introduce John Lenczowski to you, who has had a very distinguished career in foreign affairs generally and in Polish affairs in particular. And a man I knew slightly back in the 80s when we were both working in the vineyards of the Department of State. He is an assistant to the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, and I as head of Eastern European Affairs. And we went through some very troubled and glorious times. He moved over to the White House, and I moved out to Warsaw. The White House was making a policy, and I was trying to execute it. And although we had some little tugging this way and that during those years, it all came out very happily in the end. Mr. Lenczowski has left the State Department to form his own after a very distinguished career as author of a number of books on perestroika, has founded his own institute of political affairs, the Institute of World Politics in Washington, which is busily and successfully educating the next generation of practitioners in the world of foreign affairs. Now that the problems of the Cold War are behind us, we are facing a whole series of new problems. And some of them have similarities and some of them are different from the ones we faced back in the 80s. John is going to speak to us today on the subject of emboldening dissidents. It's something that we both know a good deal about. Emboldening dissidents is something we've been doing for decades in the United States, and it has led not only to some of the greatest triumphs of American foreign policy, but also to some of the most shameful episodes in U.S. foreign policy. So today, I noted in reading John's biography, I knew vaguely that we were both fellow Californians, but I didn't realize that, as it says in his bio, he was educated at the Thatcher School, earned his BA at the University of California, Berkeley, an MA and PhD from Johns Hopkins. I find that a very felicitous phrase, educated at the Thatcher School. I was educated at the Webb School, which is the great rival. We used to beat Thatcher regularly in football, but that was a whole generation before John came along. In any case, it's a great pleasure today to introduce somebody who has made a very positive contribution over the years to American foreign policy. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. It's a great pleasure to be here with you all, and I've been a very long-time admirer of Professor Thompson, and I remember with great fondness my days in the department with Ambassador Davis, and I also wanted to express my special appreciation to my colleague, Marek Hodakiewicz, who has been doing brilliant work in this field and who helped grease the skids a little bit for getting me involved in here with your program. I look very much forward to continuing to to collaborate with him in academic vineyards. Today, I would like to talk about really one of the great sea changes of modern history, and this is the collapse of the Soviet Empire. Let me just begin by saying that there are a number of different theories of why it collapsed. Many people say it was because of the military buildup that put tremendous pressure on the Soviet military-industrial complex, that this military buildup was also a sign of our resistance to Soviet advances in the world. Another theory says that we put a lot of economic pressures on the Soviet regime through our technology, security, and export control policies, through our efforts to lower the oil prices in the world by persuading the Saudis to raise their levels of production, thereby denying the Soviets the critical hard currency earnings on which they so much depended. Other people cite President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, which was one of the key elements that trumped, at least the Soviets certainly perceived it to have done so, or to have threatened to trump the huge Soviet investment in ICBMs and other advanced weapon systems. Finally, people cite the internal weaknesses of the Soviet system, both political and economic, which contributed to its collapse. Well, all of these theories are partly true, and we find validation of these from the words of many people, even former Soviet government officials. But none of them satisfactorily answers two main questions. One is that how did any of these factors bring millions of Soviet and East European citizens to demonstrate in the streets, to go on strike against the various regimes? And these included the Solidarity Movement in Poland, the coal miners of the Donbas and the Kuzbas, whose strike nearly brought the entire Soviet economy to its knees. And the second question is, how did any of these aforementioned factors or theories cause the Communist Party itself to give up its hold on power? Well, as a participant in some of these, some of the policies that were involved, I have my own theory. I don't know if it's completely correct, but it's the one which seems most persuasive to me. And I will just say this, that I believe that there were really two proximate causes for the Soviet collapse. One is that the Soviet regime faced massive internal popular resistance, including street demonstrations, strikes, dissident movements, independent movements within each of the constituent republics and satellite countries, amongst all of the various national minority groups. And secondly, the Communist Party lost its internal discipline and its ability to use sufficient force to suppress the resistance and these independence movements. Ultimately, I believe that these proximate reasons were precipitated by two major things. One was the revival by President Reagan of public diplomacy, and secondly, the election of Pope John Paul II as Pope, and perhaps they should be reversed in terms of time. Now, how did all of this happen? One of the main causes for the undermining, one of the main causes of this collapse was the undermining of the internal security system of the Soviet state. This system included total control of all communications and information media, including the domestic propaganda instruments such as radio, television, newspapers, film, theater, books, etc., control of the entire educational system, the jamming of foreign radio broadcasts, the hermetic sealing of the borders, with an extremely tight customs system and 200,000 KGB border guards, control of the entire economy, including job placement, production and distribution decisions, and so on, the parasitism laws, the internal passport system, the KGB, its network of block committees and informants, and so on and so on and so on. This system was designed to address the main threat to the regime. And that threat was not American nuclear weapons. It was the threat of the Soviet and the other subject peoples themselves. The central fact of life in the Soviet Empire and in the Soviet Union itself, and it happens to be the same in places like China today, was the regime's fear of its own people and of the very ideas of democracy. No one elected the Soviet Communist Party. It seized power over a fragile democratic provisional government. It lost the first elections to the Constituent Assembly. It shot the non-communist electoral victors. And by democratic standards, it was an illegitimate government. And the Soviet leaders knew it. So they had to prove their legitimacy in some other way. And in order to create a psychological climate that was conducive to internal security, they had to show that there was some rational, practical, or moral reason why it deserved to be in power. And then maybe its subject people could accept its rule without protest. Marxist-Leninist ideology was the legitimizing vehicle. It said that the party deserved to be in power because it understood the inexorable forces of history better than anyone else. It was the vanguard of the oppressed working class, and it uniquely could lead the working class to the radiant future of the socialist paradise. Now, we in the West take legitimacy for granted. We have peaceful transfers of power from one president to another. But in a country where the people rule without the consent of the governed, legitimacy is a very big deal. And it is related directly to the psychological climate that conduces towards sound internal security. After seven decades, this ideological reason for why they deserve to be in power ceased to be effective, because the system itself was failing in so many ways. The socialist system had a crisis of legitimacy that intensified as the system repeatedly failed to live up to its promises. Another main function of the Marxist-Leninist ideology was to provide the party with an aura of inevitability and invincibility that derived from these inexorable laws of history. Soviet foreign policy was designed to bolster this. So long as Moscow could continue to secure more expansionist victories and communist takeovers, and so long as none of these regimes ever fell from power, which up until the 1980s, until 1983, no communist regime, once having consolidated power, ever was replaced by or transformed itself into a non-communist regime. For those of us who were in government until that time, it looked like the most permanent thing that could happen politically. Once you get a communist takeover, you're in power forever. And it wasn't until President Reagan's invasion of Grenada and the toppling of that regime, that communist regime, that we had seen it ever. But we had never seen it done on its own. And so if these things were permanent and communism could never transform itself into non-communism, then perhaps the worldwide victory of communism was inevitable after all. And all of this aura of inevitability helped with the internal security system of the state. Well, indeed, here in America, in the 1970s, a large part of the foreign policy establishment believed at least a part of this idea. Namely, we thought that by supporting the anti-communist movements and forces in Central America, we were on the wrong side of history. And that we were simply fighting against inevitable, inexorable forces. Well, Vladimir Bukovsky the great Soviet human rights activist, once explained this, the main purpose of Soviet foreign policy. He said it was designed to send a message to the peoples of the USSR. Attention, Soviet people. We, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, can shoot down Korean airliners. We can invade Afghanistan. We can send arms to the communists in Central America right under the nose of Uncle Sam, and not even the greatest imperialist power in the world can resist us. And the imperialists have nuclear weapons. They have navies that sail the seas. So they can't resist us. So how can you people behind the Berlin Wall and all of those KGB border guards even contemplate resisting us? The party's message through its foreign policy was like that of the invading aliens. Resistance is futile. The ideology had another internal security function. It set the standard against which deviationism was measured. It was like the drum beating for soldiers marching. Anyone failing to march in step with that drum beat could be identified by the sergeant as a nonconformist and could be disciplined appropriately. The ideology set the standard of conformity in both thought and speech. Everybody in the court had to say that the naked emperor was wearing beautiful clothes, and they said so out of fear. They all repeated the official lies, and the regime didn't care whether they did it as a sign of loyalty or whether it was a sign of subjugation. It made no difference. All they had to do was say that the emperor was legitimate, and so did foreign leaders. And Soviet foreign policy was designed to ensure that all of the foreign leaders would say that the naked emperor was wearing beautiful clothes as well. And if you didn't actually say that they were a legitimate government, you at least had to stand silently in the court while everybody else said so. It was Ronald Reagan who upset this apple cart, and the Pope. They were the little boys in the court who told the truth. They had the courage to do so. And in the case of President Reagan, in the face of massive public criticism, that his truth-telling was recklessly provocative. He told the truth about Soviet behavior. In his first press conference, he said that they would lie and they would cheat and they would commit any crime to further the goals of communism. He said that they had a different morality than ours, and he was exactly clinically correct, in spite of the howls from the media. Every Soviet school child had to read Lenin's speech to the youth leagues of 1921, where he lays out, go look it up, it's in the second part of that speech, and it's an extraordinary document of the 20th century, that indeed there is no such thing as an objective morality. This is entirely an exercise of bourgeois subjectivism. Lenin said that anything that is good for the revolution is good, and anything that that hinders the revolution is evil. An entirely contingent morality, completely rejecting the notion that there are objective moral standards by which one can judge good and evil in the world, and behavior in the world. Well, the president told the truth about Soviet behavior in Poland, in Afghanistan, in Central America, towards their own people. He talked about the human rights violations. He talked about the Soviet military buildup. He talked about the illegitimacy of the regime. And by doing this, he revived diplomatic relations with the peoples of the Soviet Empire, not the government. He reconnected with the people, which is something that previous governments had not done in any strategic way. The closest we had come to it earlier in the Cold War was in the late 40s, early 50s, when the CIA and the State Department were involved in active efforts to try to support resistance within the Soviet Empire, but all of that started fading away in the 60s when we began to think that, oh, de-Stalinization would start, would prove to be a real liberalization of the regime. And then, you know, we had the detente period, and everything was kissy face with the Soviet regime, and it was there were summit meetings, and everybody was it was going to be peace and happiness forever. And then, at least fortunately, we hadn't completely dropped our concern about human rights. And even though I have my tremendous reservations about the way we conducted the Helsinki. The Helsinki Final Act in 1975, at least we acknowledged that, and we compelled the Soviets to acknowledge that the that human rights were an important part and a legitimate legitimate object of international political concern, and that helped indeed spark some of the dissident movements within the Soviet Empire. President Carter also, in my mind, although I was a Republican political appointee, I cheered when President Carter started the human rights campaign. It was a master stroke after what I considered to be the realpolitik, the excessive realpolitik of the policies of detente of the previous Republican administrations. And this was something that indeed gave new hope, emboldening people within the Soviet Empire. Unfortunately, when President Carter would go then and have a summit meeting and kiss Brezhnev on the cheek, that's the, my reference to some of the kissy face, all of this, this had an effect of undermining our solidarity with the peoples of this part of the world. We were, in a sense, by doing this, we were saying, this is a legitimate government. These are people with whom we can do business. We don't have any objection in principle to the way they're behaving towards their people, and that somehow we can manage to muddle through and get everything going. Well, President Reagan upset this apple cart. He reconnected with the people in a serious way. He gave them hope. He showed them resistance was possible, and that real strength was not material, but it was fundamentally moral. This was the revival of public diplomacy, a jargon term that refers to having relations with foreign publics and not just with governments. It covers the entire spectrum of methods, including cultural diplomacy, exchanges, visitor programs, information policy, distribution of literature abroad, American libraries abroad, international broadcasting, political action, presidential rhetoric, and all of the messages contained through these various venues. Collectively, they are amongst the most powerful and cost-effective instruments of American power. And yet, for years, they have been systematically neglected and relegated to tertiary status in our national strategy. No one becomes ambassador by being concentrating on these things and being good at them. No agency in the U.S. government makes public diplomacy, political warfare, or psychological strategy its principal business. But it was Ronald Reagan's revival of public diplomacy that sparked the collapse of the USSR by emboldening popular resistance to the regime. The very act of telling the truth about the Soviet regime was a sign that an American president was capable himself of moral resistance, and that this meant that the Soviet peoples and the people and the peoples of the larger empire could do so themselves. When John Paul II came, he went to Poland. And before crowds of millions, he repeated Jesus' words, "Be not afraid." And he told the truth. And these words inspired the Polish people to remember their heroic national legacy and its relationship to their religious faith. These were words that galvanized the Solidarity movement and helped it become the mass movement against the worker state. And it was that movement that showed others within the Soviet Empire that the formation of mass resistance was possible. And it became the model for the Baltic movements, the so-called People's Fronts, which, even though they were penetrated by the KGB, became the instructors of the mass movements of resistance within each of the other constituent republics of the USSR. To the extent that finally, when I think it was Tajikistan became independent, and after the final collapse of the Soviet Union, they had some kind of a law on some matter. And the Tajiks said, our law on blah-de-blah-de-blah is the same one as in the Estonian law. And that was good enough for them. They said it's simply the same one. That was their shorthand for saying what their law was. And it was just the tip of this iceberg of how these movements within the Stans and the Caucasus and elsewhere were very much modeled on the resistance movements that came out of the Baltic states, which in turn were modeled after the Solidarity movement. Solzhenitsyn once explained the importance of the battle between truth and falsehood. And this battle between truth and self-censorship, which was such an important part of life within the Soviet Empire. He said in his letter to the Soviet leaders in 1975, I believe it was, he said, in our country, the lie has been incorporated into the state system as the vital link holding everything together, with billions of tiny fasteners, several dozen to each man. This is precisely why we find life so oppressive. When oppression is not accompanied by the lie, liberation requires political measures. But when the lie has fastened its claws on us, it is no longer a matter of politics. It is an invasion of man's moral world. And our straightening up and refusing to lie is also not political, but simply a retrieval of our human dignity. Telling the truth. This was the methodology of the resistance movements within the Soviet Empire. How to make it the Solidarity movement and Václav Havel and the Czech resistors pioneered this. It was like Alcoholics Anonymous. How do you get through just one day without telling a lie? One day, just get through one day and don't repeat the lie, the official lies. And then you can look at yourself in the mirror at the end of that day and with some kind of self-respect. And maybe if you can do it one day at a time, you can reclaim your moral dignity. And when it is done on a mass scale, the society can reclaim its moral dignity. One of the most important measures taken by President Reagan in his battle for the truth was the revival and the strengthening of the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. The latter two differed from the Voice of America because these were the domestic surrogate radios, the domestic surrogate free press of these areas that were denied a free press. It was Poles talking to Poles, Czechs talking to Czechs, Uzbeks talking to Uzbeks about news in their own respective nations, not simply about world news and so on. And they had historical programs that would retrieve the real history, not the revised history. They would take the history that Lenin and Stalin and his successors had flushed down Orwell's memory hole and restore the national memory to these people. They would have religious programs. They would have news about plane crashes and things which were never supposed to happen and never did happen in the socialist paradise, according to the Soviet and communist media. These radios had the only unfiltered information that we could send to the peoples of the Soviet Empire. They gave them alternative ideas. These radios fought the battle of ideas, the battle of truth and falsehood on a daily basis. The radios combated the regime's attempt to atomize society. This was one of the most important instruments of communist control. People would isolate, the regime would isolate individuals from one another, creating a climate where nobody could trust anybody else. At the worst periods, you would risk even being turned into the authorities by your children if you were criticizing the regime over the dinner table. And so the Soviets built the monument to Pavlik Morozov, who was a 12-year-old boy or something, who turned in his parents to the NKVD. They were executed, and they built a statue to him to celebrate him as a great citizen and patriot. Secret listeners could establish relations with each other when they found other secret listeners. The dissident movement in Poland was very much the avant-garde of all of this resistance. And a large part of this was due precisely to these radios. These radios were one of the single greatest threats to Soviet rule, which is why the regime jammed them so intensively and so pervasively, and constantly attempted to infiltrate the radio's staffs with KGB provocateurs. The radios were an expression of solidarity with the peoples of the Soviet Empire, and they were decisive in emboldening resistance. For a couple of decades, they had been neglected by the U.S. foreign policy establishment. And there were many efforts to try to shut them down as antiques of the early bad days of the Cold War, as recklessly provocative instruments that were destroying the possibility of detente, and so on and so forth. But President Reagan revived them. When asked how important these radios were in building the Solidarity Movement, its leader and later Polish president, Lech Walesa, said, he was asked about this, how important are these radios? And he responded in Washington, would there be life on Earth without the sun? Alexander Solzhenitsyn once said, the power that resides in the airwaves to kindle the human spirit is beyond the scope of the Western imagination. We have a materialistic foreign policy culture in Washington. If it isn't guns and rockets and boxes of cash and the diplomacy dealing with these things, it's not strategically important. And yet, the fact is that what really is strategically important is what's in people's hearts, what's in their minds. It's the battle of ideas, of values, of religions. Look at what we're dealing with Al-Qaeda and the others. This isn't a question of guns and money. It's a question of beliefs. Now, one reason why the Solidarity Movement succeeded as well as it did in Poland, as the avant-garde of the resistance inside the Soviet Empire, was that it was extremely well-informed. The radio signals got to Poland better than almost any other place, certainly better than in the USSR. And because the signals got to the country, the people in the underground had incentives to establish underground lines of communication with each other. Why? Because they knew that if those underground lines of communication could ultimately get information about what were the events inside the country to the West, particularly to Munich, the headquarters of Radio Free Europe, then that same message could be broadcast to the whole rest of the country. Another really important strategic element in all of this is the fact that whenever there was a civil disturbance inside the Soviet Empire, the regimes there had a technique of dealing with it, and that would be to isolate it, to cut off all communications from that location. And if the rest of the country, and then they would crush it, they would shoot the people, execute them, arrest them, whatever. And then if everybody else in the country learned about it a few weeks later, okay, no problem particularly if they learned about it. They might not for a long time. But if they did weeks later, it wouldn't have the same contagious effect as if they learned about it immediately. And so the communist regimes were afraid not only of the truth, but they were afraid of the instantaneity of the communication of truth. And so what happened when the Solidarity strikes began in the shipyards of Gdansk was that the Polish regime immediately shut off all communications to that city. And they said, oh, there was some kind of high winds that blew down the telephone lines, and so nobody could communicate with the city. And of course, since the truth is what the Communist Party says it is, there must have been a hurricane or something like that. There was nobody to say otherwise, except the underground lines of communication established by the Solidarity Movement, because they knew that they could get a message elsewhere, and that by utilizing those and because there were those radios, it was less risky to have to establish those underground lines than otherwise. And so the message got to the entire Polish people within a matter of hours that these strikes were actually happening. And by the way, it is not guaranteed that this kind of message can escape the communist world within a matter of hours. While Ambassador Davis and I were in office, there was a soccer game in Vilnius, the capital of Lithuania, of Soviet Lithuania at the time. And it was a game between the Russian team and the Lithuanian team. And it was right around the time of the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, and the whole city was decked out in red bunting and portraits of Lenin and the others. And all of a sudden, the crowd in the stadium started chanting anti-Soviet, anti-Russian slogans. And pretty soon, it turned into a wholesale riot. The crowd streamed down onto the field. The countrywide televised broadcast was immediately shut off, for technical difficulties, of course. And then the people streamed out of this stadium onto the streets and started tearing down all of the red bunting in a massive protest. And this is in Lithuania, right next door to Poland, right across the Baltic from Scandinavia. And we in the West did not learn about this demonstration and this civil unrest for 6 months until after it happened. That is how a hermetically sealed totalitarian society can work. And that is how we couldn't learn about the vast nuclear accident in Kyshtym in the Ural Mountains for at least 15 years after it happened. And it was arguably something worse than Chernobyl. And many of you have probably never even heard of that one. And yet, hundreds of square miles of the Ural Mountains remain irradiated today because of that accident. Nobody knows. That's what totalitarianism is. Well, the Poles, and because of those radios, got the information to the rest of the country within hours, and within a matter of days, the contagion spread so that it was 10 million people. Practically the entire adult working population of the country had joined the Solidarity Movement. How did they... Let me just tell you one other little story about this. One day on a bus, a guy got onto a bus in Warsaw, and he started whistling a song that he had heard only on Radio Free Europe. Couldn't hear it on Warsaw official stations, only on Radio Free Europe. This was in the 50s. And he started whistling this song. And a few minutes later, somebody else started whistling it with him. And then somebody else started whistling it, and pretty soon the whole bus was whistling this song. And they all looked at each other,
And I said, we are all secret listeners. There are more of us than there are of them. And maybe if, you know, when one of us sticks his neck out, it gets chopped off. But when all of us, all 1 million or 2 million of us, right here with the Pope in the big field, stick our necks out together, they can't chop it off. That's solidarity. That's solidarity. So, the dissident movements flowered. There were vast efforts at distribution of underground literature, smuggling operations from all over the place to get things into the country. There were the flying universities, where they would go from one apartment to another apartment to another apartment, holding classes, so that the KGB could never come back and get them at the same place, or the UB, the Polish secret police. And and what was happening in these? They were reviving, they were teaching the history of the country, getting back their national memory. And of course, I had a distant relative whose way of resisting communism was to become a scholar of medieval history. Why medieval history? Because that was one thing that they would permit people to study without it being totally ideologized. And they were able to reclaim their national history by keeping alive such relatively esoteric subjects. So, of course, already in the 70s, in the early 70s, there were the bread riots in Poland and the beginnings of a labor movement in Poland. By 1976, you had the Workers' Defense Committee, the KOR, which became one of the core elements of solidarity. 1978 saw the election of the Pope, 79 saw his visit, and then let us not underestimate the role of the church in all of this. The church is something that the communists would have loved to have smashed. They couldn't. They weren't strong enough to do it. They had aspirations to do so. They succeeded in doing so in the Soviet Union, but not in Poland. They did not have the strength. And the result was that the church remained an island of autonomy, as they call it, in the totalitarian sea. And they were able to speak the truth. One of the great leaders of the solidarity movement was Father Jerzy Popieluszko, who would give these sermons every week, week after week after week, emboldening people's resistance through spiritual warfare, because people ultimately recognized that this was a contest, not just a political contest, it was a contest between good and evil, between the truth and falsehood. He would start out a mass with something like this. Some crosses and some swords, such is our destiny. And our years succeed one another, and our blood and our pleas, the unwritten pact is sealed upon the whole country in this world. The glory and the sorrow, the bitter harvest with which you sit before your threshold, and in vain you seek for a glance from all sides, a wandering old figure bent to the soil before your final judge, God. And our trial which lasts, how to overcome the defeat and the absence of a pathway, and to bear in one's hand the armor of the cherubim, lashing out everywhere at evil and distress by which we have not yet managed to defeat ourselves. How, stronger than this, the rocks which rain upon us, stronger than the free hand and stronger than the arbitrary and perjurious hand which beats down upon us, cry that we are tireless, that our heart broken in our breast will neither bend nor change. How rise above the despair and the pains, the heavenly time and the movement of the clock, and read through the centuries the chosen lot of their non-written Polish pact. Death is perishable, faith eternal. And then he would say, the intention of the Holy Mass that we are celebrating today is the prosperity of our fatherland and peace for our fatherland. In the course of the Mass, we will pray especially for those who are deprived of liberty, arrested, interned, condemned, for them and for their families. Even though because of the decision of the authorities, the Solidarity Union may be suspended, we may be permitted this day to mention a special anniversary. Exactly 1 year ago, the bells of our church announced with a joyous voice the blessing of the flag of solidarity belonging to the steelworkers of Warsaw. Monsignor Kraszewski represented on this occasion our lamented primate. We are therefore going to pray in a special way for the steelworkers of Warsaw and all the steelworkers of the country. This kind of thing went on week after week after week. It was spiritual warfare. Let's get back to politics. President Reagan showed that resistance was possible in many other ways. In the face of massive Soviet-led peace propaganda, he pulled off his military buildup. He sent aid to the Solidarity movement in Poland through all sorts of channels, the CIA, the AFL-CIO. He sent aid to the Nicaraguan resistance, the Afghan Mujahideen, the resistance, communist resistance movements in southern Africa. He toppled the communist regime in Grenada as part of the rescue mission of the American students there. He launched the National Endowment for Democracy, giving America the first overt capability to support democratic forces, a capability which previously had been covert and which risked getting politically stained by being associated with secret intelligence activities. The spirit of his policies was completely in conformity with the spirit of those resistance movements. And while some of our elites tried to prohibit aid to the anti-communist forces in Central America, the Solidarity Movement was stealing Soviet arms from the Soviet munitions depots in Poland, putting them on ships in Gdynia, the Polish port of Gdynia, and sending these arms to the Nicaraguan anti-communist resistance. And they knew, the Poles knew, that if resistance could succeed in Central America, the people in the inner empire would regain their courage. That before there could be freedom in Warsaw, there had to be freedom in Managua. The Poles did this. And they went and fought with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. I met one of these guys, and he gave me a photograph. It was a little still life. It was a picture of his Afghan hat with his Kalashnikov rifle and his rosary. He went to Poland to kill Soviets. I mean, he went to Afghanistan to kill Soviets. Altogether, President Reagan fought communism, not with anti-communism, not just with anti-communism, but with a positive message of hope, of liberty and democracy, of moral resistance to the lie, and of tangible material help as well. Meanwhile, of course, the economic crisis was growing within the Soviet Empire. There was a crisis of legitimacy. Gorbachev was attempting to make the system work better. He tried exhortations. He tried the restoration of Stalin-style labor discipline and the restoration of collective punishment. Gorbachev tried all sorts of things, phony cost accounting. He tried one thing after another. None of it worked. The Reagan policies of technology denial, the U.S. policies of the sabotage of high-tech equipment that we would
that the Soviets thought that they were buying from us. That was a very interesting operation. Our policies to deny hard currency, all of this put pressure on the Soviet military-industrial complex. And the economic crisis, of course, in the Soviet Union was simply, it was not a crisis of consumer goods. That crisis started back in 1917. It was really a crisis of the military-industrial complex. Gorbachev ultimately, who was trying to save the Soviet system, lost any popular support that he might have had. The people hated him. The intelligentsia were alienated. They decided that socialism was a failure and ultimately illegitimate. Gorbachev then tried his Glasnost campaign. He tried also to attack the underground economy, because that was something that was subverting party discipline. The Communist Party was supposed to be principally party-minded, but instead what they were doing was many of them were involved in bribery and ultimately in investing and operations in the underground economy. Gorbachev put a crackdown on all of this because of this lack of party discipline. He had a huge anti-corruption campaign. His anti-corruption campaign involved the arrest and prosecution of 250,000 members of the party and managerial elite. And his crackdown on the underground economy involved the arrest where 800,000 private underground entrepreneurs in the Soviet Union, estimated figure, either were arrested or fled their jobs for fear of arrest because of this whole crackdown. Gorbachev then tried different kinds of liberalization methods. The whole Glasnost campaign originally was a campaign that was associated with the anti-corruption campaign. It was a method of getting people to inform on party members who were corrupt, but it ended up getting out of control. And the Soviet people themselves put their foot in the door and prevented Gorbachev from slamming it on them. They used it as a vehicle as an opportunity for greater freedom of speech. Gorbachev's goons repeatedly harassed, beat up, and arrested the burgeoning crop of dissident writers. But he couldn't do what he really wanted to do, which was to throw them in the gulag. And the reason for that was that he felt that the only salvation of his military economy was from two things. One was the physical disarmament of the West, and secondly, the need to seek an economic bailout of the West, from the West. And so he started this whole public relations campaign with the West, but any attempt to throw these people into the gulag would have undermined that public relations campaign, and the West wouldn't have given him the economic benefits that particularly the Germans did, and we wouldn't have done the disarmament that we started already in 1985. A crackdown on his people would have jeopardized his entire attempt to save the system. And it wasn't, of course, as if Gorbachev didn't attempt some last-ditch efforts to save the system. He invaded Lithuania. His thugs used poison gas on the demonstrators in Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, and is slaughtering many of those people with sharpened military shovels. He deployed poison gas against the demonstrators in Moldavia. He invaded Baku for this ostensible purpose of keeping the peace, and after his own KGB had provoked persecutions and pogroms between the Armenians and the Azeris. But all of this last-minute attempts of Gorbachevian violence were too little too late. The party had its own crisis. It had lost its discipline. It had become bureaucratized. The people, it had become corrupt. And meanwhile, some people like Boris Yeltsin, who became
personally alienated from the entire Soviet enterprise because of the denunciation sessions that the party had perpetrated against him personally, started calling for sedition, calling on Soviet troops not to shoot at their own people in the invasion of Lithuania. And finally, we know what happened. The whole thing collapsed. But it didn't collapse until millions of those people took to the streets. The demonstrators who were emboldened. Now, let me just conclude by saying here that none of this could have happened without the presidential leadership that was intent on connecting with the people and emboldening these people to resist. When President Reagan went to Moscow State University, he electrified internal resistance to Sovietism. He spoke of the freedom to create and to innovate. He spoke of the stultification of bureaucracy. He spoke of the self-evident truths of our Declaration of Independence and how freedom is not the gift of the state, but the gift of God. He spoke of the irresistible power of unarmed truth as the indispensable instrument of genuine reform. He understood the Cold War in the way millions in the Soviet Empire understood it. Not as a war between the people of the East and the people of the West, but as a war between two philosophies of life. Those who believe that there is a transcendent, objective, universal moral order in the world versus those who don't. Those, in other words, who believe that all standards of right and wrong are simply matters of personal preference, determined by personal, financial, sensual, political, or social convenience, which means that such standards at a societal level are in fact determined by a struggle for power, or in other words, a struggle for might makes right. Either there is a transcendent, objective, universal moral order in the world, or right and wrong are determined by power struggle. You take your choice. That's what the Cold War was really all about. The peoples of the Soviet Empire understood this, and they were sick of a system of might makes right, because that makes for capricious lawmaking and arbitrary judgment. President Reagan understood this. The Pope understood this. The people, Father Popielushko, understood it. At one critical point of history, the courage of a few people to tell the truth and the courage ultimately of millions of people within the Soviet Empire to refuse to lie and to stand up for what they knew in their hearts was objectively good did more than anything else to bring about one of the most revolutionary. Thank you.